Hey everybody, so before we jump into today's podcast, I just wanted to A, thank you guys, give you a little bit of a reminder. If you enjoy this content, however you're watching it, consuming it, please like, follow, subscribe, whatever you gotta do, comment on it if you can, leave us a review. It really helps us out and it can help grow our platform and reach more people. And if you know someone that can benefit from this, please share it with them. If you have a question, if you wanna reach out to us, let us know. And then lastly, we have all of our amazing programs, courses, and coaching available in the resources below. So check that out. Definitely take advantage of it. We have everything from free options all the way up to paid programs and everything in between to fit pretty much anyone's budget. And it's just a matter of how customized it's going to be based on the price point. So there's really something for everybody. Thank you guys. Let's get on into the episode. Yeah, fighters. What's going on, everybody? Mike here, Life of a Fighter podcast, episode 99. We're coming up on 100, guys. So I'm going to do a fun little announcement and some giveaways and fun stuff being announced on what it's going to be on episode 100. So make sure you're tuning in for that. And before we jump into today's topic of brain myths, we got a lot of fun stuff, myths and misconceptions. I'm probably going to break it down into a two-part series because there's just so much here to cover, which is why it's coming out a couple days late. And I didn't want to really skip over any of the good stuff. But before we jump into that, got to give a shout-out to NutriPrice, our online food provider. NutriPrice.com and Life of a Fighter have partnered up. And we wanted to share this with you guys. So you can go to NutriPrice.com or you can go click on the link below. And your first three orders, you're going to get a 15% discount. And you're going to get free shipping on all of your orders as long as it's $1 or more, which I'm pretty sure you guys will be able to handle that. And one of the biggest reasons that we decided to go with NutriPrice, especially for a food shopping market over all the other competitors out there, is A, it's one of the fastest growing wholesale markets on the internet right now. B, it's going to be top quality products. And C, the award-winning customer service. And an extra underlying bonus incentive is you get a money-back guarantee on your orders. So again, going back to the online aspect of food shopping, we've talked about it in other episodes, and I highly recommend if you haven't heard them, go back, give them a listen. I think it's episode 97, and A Fighter's Guide to Food Shopping. We talk about all the benefits and where ordering online can fit into your healthy lifestyle versus going into the store and doing it that way. And I highly recommend utilizing NutriPrice as a resource for that, but also the quality of the food that you're going to get. If there is an issue, if you have any problems, the quality of the customer care that we haven't even talked about, but to me that's a big aspect about anytime you're going to work with an organization or you're going to work with a company or you're going to decide to hand over your money to a company or brand, you want to make sure that not only are they going to take your money and then just kind of hand off like, all right, here's a product, whatever. But if you have a problem, if there's an issue, if anything's going wrong, or you just have questions, you have someone you can talk to, there's someone on the other side, and they actually care about what you're asking about, what you have to say. And to me, a really big one that I love that NutriPrice does is a money-back guarantee. So if you're not happy with your order, reach out to them. They'll take care of it, get your money back, all that good stuff. Not that I think you really will have an issue, but again, just in case, for whatever reason, it's there. And it'll make your life that much easier. So, for example, today I got crazy stuff going on. I don't have to run to the store and buy all the different things on my food shopping list. I can get a majority of the things I want. I'm going to get them from NutriPrice. And then I just got to fill in a couple of the spots of some things that I want from specific local-based stores. And we've talked about that in prior episodes. I'm not going to get into it. But, yeah, check them out. NutriPrice, NutriPrice.com. You can get the link below. See them on our social media, all that good stuff. So shout out to them. Next, we got Audible, especially for this podcast because I listen to all my books on Audible. This is a great resource for you guys. So anyone that wants to also get the book that I'm breaking down, Brain Myths and Misconceptions by The Greater Courses, which is really a larger textbook, you can go to Audible, click on the link again below. You can get a free trial for 30 days. They give you a credit. You can order a book, anything that you want. And if you don't like it, cool. Keep the book. You can cancel. You don't have to pay anything. It's not going to cost you anything. I think it's a great, again, tool that you can use, get great information, and just entertain yourselves. And we're going to be constantly, again, every month breaking down a book. I'm going to be doing recaps, all that fun stuff. So take advantage of it while you can. And as part of Audible, we got Amazon. Amazon's one of our affiliates. You can click on the link below if you want to support the podcast. It doesn't cost you anything, but we get a little kickback. Nothing crazy, but you know, hey, it all adds up, and we appreciate the support, guys. And last but not least, the Life of a Fighter shop, where we have all of our great products, services, whether it's you want to sign up for our fitness and nutrition vault and get access to all of our private content, whether you want to sign up for our Pro Coach program and have a coach working with you one-on-one, customizing your nutrition and training goals, evaluating what your pretty much kind of lifestyle should be. And then we also have our premium coaching service, which takes it up another step that's really going to take you to that next level, where we'll help you from every aspect of your day-to-day life, but also include personal training sessions, also include nutrition shopping sessions, anything you're going to need, blood work, again, your meal prep, all that fun stuff, it's going to be in there. Check it out on the shop. And a cool thing that I'm excited that I just recently launched, like kind of like a soft launch, and we're going to kind of expand it more and more as the 2018 year rolls along, is our fighter guides. And we've been doing this with our ebooks, where I've put all of our ebooks in our fitness and nutrition vault. But for whatever reason, if you didn't want all of them and you don't want the vault access and you just want one ebook, you can buy it on our shop. We're going to do the same thing with our fighter guides, because after a couple weeks, I locked those fighter guides out back in our vault. So whether you haven't had a chance to view it, or you saw it but you want to get back to it, it's going to be in our vault, so you need Fitness Vault access to get to it. And if for whatever reason you don't want to get access to all of those different pieces of content in the vault and you just want one fighter's guide, we're going to make it available to you guys. You could purchase the fighter's guide now as well. You can get a full access. We'll deliver it in a PDF or just a link to the website. You can get them both. So check out the shop, and I'm doing a special right now. We're going to put them up for $1. So for $1, you can get access to the entire fighter's guide. What I'm going to end up doing is that price point is going to go up, just letting you guys know, because of the demand I've already kind of heard back from some things we've reached out and some interest and the resources that I put in. But I want to make it available in the initial phases. So if you take advantage of it, once it goes private, within the first week or two, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it a week or two yet. We'll see the response we get. If you take advantage of it in that first week or two, you get access to it for $1. If you wait longer, the price is going to go up. I'm not going to charge you more than $10, though, because even $10 to me is a fair price point for all the information you're going to get out of our fighter's guide. I take a lot of time and I put a lot of information and resources into these fighter guides, so take advantage of it. Bam! All right, guys, without further ado, we're going to jump into this fighter's guide and podcast episode 99, talking about our brain myths, specifically myths and misconceptions. Okay, so this was awesome because in each chapter they highlight a specific myth and then they break down the truth of it and then also go into more details of what exactly that truth really is going to mean, where the myth came from, and some other bits of the brain, some information that's going to highlight why we even have these myths in the first place, what's it based out of, and all that fun stuff. So the first myth we're going to cover, and the first one they jump right into, is your brain is perfectly designed. I think this is a great topic, especially to lead off the book and to also lead off our fighter's guide. So let's think about that for a second. Is our brain perfectly designed? So many people make that comparison, and I've heard it myself, where there's more neurological connections and synapses in our brain than there are stars in the galaxy, which turns out not to be true. And it doesn't take anything away from the brain, the complexity of the brain, the impressiveness of it. I'm not saying it's not impressive, but our brains are not perfectly designed. There are mistakes. There are evolutionary hacks that have put into place or that our brain has evolved through that have kind of made us a little less efficient. So not only can these hacks be frustrating, they can also be wonderful. So the idea is, maybe we had to have a certain operation system, for example, whether we talk about our five senses, which we'll explore later, or we'll talk into other myths that we'll dive into later, or how our brain is organized and we have different sections of the brain and how we have our occipital lobe, we have our frontal lobe, we have all these different aspects and they're broken up, which can be a benefit, but also because the speed at which our brain evolved and taking some of those steps and some of the procedures in it, it allowed certain, obviously, let's say vulnerabilities or certain little holes in the brain, not literally, figuratively. But then we can even talk about how there may actually be literal holes after certain types of diseases and accidents and things like that. So again, the brain is not designed perfect. And I thought that was again, the great way to start this book off, because you'd think, all right, well, natural selection allowed us to evolve, and it's the best version of it, which it can be actually the best version, but it doesn't mean that it's actually perfect. Evolutionary steps may have allowed us to get better and stronger and wiser, but it doesn't mean we're at the most efficient version of ourselves. All right, so that's going to be that first chapter, and we're going to look through some more of the details, and those details we will be looking at in the actual fighter guide itself. So if you're just listening on iTunes, or you're listening on your phone, or however you're getting this podcast, and you don't have the actual fighter's guide in front of you, go over to the link below, check out the fighter's guide. We're going to have a lot of those details and bullet points highlighted, so I really want you guys to see some more of that breakdown, and I'm not going to go into all the details because I want to try and get through the first, really the goal is the first 6 to 12 chapters. There's 24 total chapters in this book, and I want to get to the first 12 of them in part 1, and then only do part 2 of this. We might end up doing 3 parts of it, of going through each chapter because I don't want to miss anything, but I also don't want to spend too much time on each one, lose you guys, or take too much time, because I got lots of really good content coming up. We got lots of really good people we want to talk to and different things. So again, we'll continue. So some interesting questions that they recommend us to consider that I'm going to read to you guys at the end of the chapter. What makes us prone to latch on to brain myths? And I think that's a really interesting question. And it's not just brain myths, just myths in general. What is it about how we operate, think, and form ideas and just quote-unquote facts that allow myths to kind of propagate and expand and develop over time? Second question that's really interesting, what dangers are there in harboring such misinformation? And I think that's kind of apparent, especially when it comes to the brain, but let's look at that for a second. So if we make an assumption of something to be true and it's a myth, and we say, okay, there's a perfect design to the brain, the danger in that is that we never really look at alternative options or there being potential holes or problems in the brain. And that's just one example. There's a lot when we look at just myths in general, misconceptions. If we believe something to be true and it's actually not, we can build entire systems, books. There's so much that we could build off of that if we're not fact-checking and going back and making sure that these quote-unquote myths aren't just being repeated, but they're actually being fact-checked. And that's what's awesome about the scientific method. And science in general as a category is because the belief behind science, scientists, science-based information is that it has to be based on, when we say quote-unquote fact, these facts are being built upon a system that's fact-checking and making sure that these are replicable, repeatable events that if I do it over here in North Carolina, you can do it, let's say, over in New York, you can do it in California, you could do it in anywhere in Asia, in Europe, in South, wherever it is, these facts will repeat themselves and they're likely to be the same finding. So I think that's really important about why we want to get rid of myths, or why we want to at least understand that they're myths. Hey, maybe they're fun to have and they're fun for stories and whatever have you, but to tie them into being fact-based, that's where we get lost. Okay, and the third question is, what are the unique challenges of thinking about thinking as opposed to thinking about anything else? All right, so this is a really fun question to me, because when we look at our brain, there's still so much we don't understand. And we do understand quite a bit, and we're getting to learn more every day, every year, but I feel like there's a lot more attention being brought to physiology, to anatomy, to all the other aspects, or even not even when we take the body out of it. There's so many things being brought to attention with, you know, media and with all the other aspects of our lives and lifestyle and what's going on social media, what's going on with entertainment world, what's going on with this movement or that movement, which is not to take away from other aspects and important factors in our lives, but knowing pretty much how our body and our brain operate, to me, should be one of the most important things that we're focusing on, so that we not only understand it, but if there's a problem, we can understand how to address it. And that's why I think, also going back to misinformation, if there's a problem and we think, let's say, one part of our brain's responsible for that issue that we may be having, but it's really another part of the brain also has a relationship to be played, then we're looking at the wrong thing, or we're only getting half of the picture, or we're only getting a bit of the information, and we can't really truly address the root issue. Okay, so that's lecture one. That's the first part of it, myth number one. Let's look at myth number two. And the myth is, the bigger the brain, the better. And I got to be honest with you guys, I was kind of, I don't want to say I was 100% in on this one, but I definitely bought some of the ideas in this myth. And the idea is, especially from an evolutionary standpoint, our brains got bigger and we got more intelligent. And that was the route that we were considered to grow. Because if you look at prior hominids or our ape ancestors or any variations of that, we think, okay, well, our bodies may have gotten weaker, but our brains have evolved and they should have gotten bigger. And that, therefore, the bigger the brain, the more intelligent it is. And there's some really interesting facts and some perspectives that I brought up that it's not just the size of the brain, it's the ratio of the brain that they started to evaluate. And they said, okay, if it's brain size, if we base it on a ratio, then let's say birds are going to have a bigger ratio of a brain. They should be smarter or smarter than we are, which they may or may not actually be, but that's a different conversation. Or if we just took it on sheer size and volume, what about whales? They have the biggest brain. What about elephants? They have one of the largest brains. And then they even say, if we quantify this as ratio of brain to size, brain size to body size, then humans clock in at about 1 to 40. Which is the same ratio as a mouse, by the way, which I thought was important that they highlight. So what they're basically saying is that if our total body size would be 40, our brain size would be 1 to it. So it's a 1 to 40 ratio. And that's really interesting because, like I said, a mouse has the same ratio and that birds are going to have a better ratio than that. So is it just the brain size and the ratio of the brain that's a factor, or is what's happening inside the brain? Is it the growth factor? Is it the neuron firing? Is it other chemicals interacting within the brain? And the truth here is intelligence and brain size. So the myth was the bigger the brain, the better. Truth, intelligence and brain size, even in humans, are only moderately correlated when you look across species. The correlation is even smaller. So it's not just when we look at people, but also when we look at all animals, there's not a very large correlation. And again, correlation doesn't mean causation, but it gives us a snapshot, an idea of what we're looking at. So I thought that was really, really interesting. And one of the biggest ones, especially highlights this specifically for people, is that Einstein's brain wasn't that large. And when we say that large, I mean, it didn't break any records, even though his IQ was top of the charts, all of that. Albert Einstein's brain was saved for analysis, and what they found was in four different sections of his brain, and at least compared with a certain cohort of war veterans from a similar time. Wait, hold on. The ratio of neurons to glial cells, I'm probably butchering that, and let's talk about that. So neurons, generally thought to be the content of the brain, glial cells, which provide the neurons with the basic necessities of life and ensure that they can concentrate on firing off or not a signal. So the neurons are what's communicating, the glial cells are what's allowing them to communicate, basically. And in Einstein's brain, these neurons and glial cells were found to be in lower amounts than in other counterparts. So if you just think about neurons, which is what makes up the brain, which is a majority of what the mass of it's going to be, and the glial cells, which is also part of the mass, but also how they communicate to one another, if Einstein had less in volume than his counterparts and his brain was actually somewhat smaller, how can he be more intelligent? So that's where that can bust the myth right there in and of itself. Now, N equals 1 is not a, what I mean by N equals 1 is that when you have a study, they're going to use N is the amount of people that you're studying. So N equals 1 would be one person studying. That's not a very significant bit of data, but even sometimes just one can give you enough insight and just gives you an interesting perspective. And for me, knowing that Einstein's brain had lower ratio, it shows that it's not necessarily in the size or the quantity, it's in other aspects of what we're looking at. So, furthermore, research on a section of Einstein's prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for complex cognition, shows that his cortex was thinner than that of the controls that they were comparing it to, but that the neurons there were more densely packed. In many studies, cortical thickness is taken to be a good thing, and aging and neurodegenerative diseases can cause cortical thinning. So, what they're talking about, a part of his brain, the prefrontal cortex, is smaller, thinner than the counterparts. However, even though it has a certain amount of neurons in there, they were more densely packed. So the thought behind that And this is what I'm gathering from that thought. And again, we can you really should we'll dive more into the Fighter's Guide itself, breaking this down, and also you could look at the book to get even more. But I'm just going to summarize it here: is when they're that packed, densed in together, the rate at which they can communicate and the relationship they have with one another is obviously having an impact. So I thought that was just interesting. Then we talk about composition of brain regions and the influence they're going to have and the aspects of that, special brains or our special brains, and just looking at some of the different breakdowns of that. And at the end of the chapter, again, we have our questions. What advantages might a bigger brain afford? And then also question number two, if it's not the size that differentiates us in terms of intelligence or other factors, what might the physiological signature of genius be? Or is there one? So that's a really important question to me, is we have an IQ test that has a certain standard, but what are some other physical markers that we could look at? So when we're talking about physical signature of a genius, so we're not talking about, okay, apply an IQ test, which doesn't really categorize under physical signatures, because it's not just, we can't just look at the brain, whether someone's alive or deceased, and evaluate it. We have to actually have them apply their brain. And that's, again, when we talk about genius, is it what the size is? Is it the physical, or is it the application of what you've been given? So you could even say someone that, let's say a bodybuilder. I think this is a really interesting example that I just kind of thought of that. Tell me if you guys like this one. If a bodybuilder looks bigger than a powerlifter and looks well more musculatured and looks just more defined, all that fun stuff, but then you put the bodybuilder and the powerlifter on the same platform and they have to lift. If the bodybuilder can't lift a pound, but the powerlifter can lift 400 pounds, that's the application of muscle. So as far as a physical signature of muscle or strength, if we just go by physical signature, okay, of what it looks like, the bodybuilder looks probably more like he's going to be stronger. But when you do the application of strength, you may see a different picture. So just because there's a physical signature, which we don't really know if there is one, but if there was one, is it really an accurate representation even of intelligence and genius? Which I doubt, honestly. I think that it has to be more of maybe, and again, they dive into a little bit more, and you guys got to bear with me here. I've listened to this book over the last 3 weeks. It hasn't been full 30 days. And I've taken lots of notes, but you know, the first even five chapters have been 2 weeks ago. So some of the details in all of these chapters, I'm kind of skipping on. So I have to go through my notes, and I'm even going through the actual text, but I'm going to put it in the Fighter's Guide as well. So some of these questions and things, I'm going to have to dive back into a little bit more in the actual text, but let's go on to the third myth and the third topic. So the third myth is going to be when the chemicals in your brain are out of balance, your brain can't function properly, which is an interesting myth, which, again, this is another one that, you know, I'm sure we've all fallen susceptible to, and I myself have. Truth, neurotransmitters, the chemicals in the brain, are only one part of healthy brain function, and their levels are in constant flux. All right, so let's break that down. What does that mean? So when we talk about chemical imbalances, and you know, I'm guilty of saying this myself, is like, oh, that person has a chemical imbalance, which is why they're acting that way, or why they're not right, or their behavior is different, or anything like that. And it's not to say that people at a long-term chronic-based disease or situation or analysis may not have the proper brain chemistry. They may actually be at a deficit consistently for a long period of time. But the idea that chemical balances in our brain are perfect all the time, I think is really the myth. The truth is these neurotransmitters and the chemicals in the brain are in flux based on food, based on lifestyle changes, based on exercise, based on sleep, based on lack of sleep, based on consumption of other supplementation. So we may have these neurotransmitters firing and there's levels changing, but there is supposed to be, let's say, a certain marker at which we want to come back to, or for consistently over a week or a 30-day or a year period, we should see certain levels coming into play. So I thought that was really interesting, that it's not as simple as, oh, okay, this person is just constantly going to have a chemical imbalance. That's, yes, that is going to be part of it, but there's multiple factors, especially when we're looking at different diagnoses and diseases and evaluations. So whether it's schizophrenia, whether we're talking about all the different aspects that come with that, whether we're talking about depression or any kind of variation of those things, there's going to be multiple factors in there besides the neurotransmitters and the chemicals, which we'll also go into. But specifically, we're going to highlight schizophrenia and depression in our notes. Okay, so now let's look at some of the questions that we're talking about. So questions to consider. How do brain chemicals, neurotransmitters, and hormones enhance the way the neurons can communicate with one another? That's a key question. So when we talk about, again, these chemical imbalances, and we talk about, you know, they're coming up, they're coming down. Do you ever feel groggy when you go without sleep? And that we'll dive more into this in the notes, and they dive into it in the book. But when you're sleeping, there's other chemical responses and things happening in your brain where you're going to be, quote unquote, recovering. And we even talk about that from a physiological standpoint. Your muscle tissue isn't repairing unless you're actually resting. Okay, if you're constantly putting in a stress state, it doesn't have the opportunity to reload or rebuild or reframe itself. Okay, and that also is going to come into play with your hormone levels, with chemicals coming into your brain, with the neurotransmitters firing. Okay, so that's really interesting that we're going to be going over, or that we're going to continuously break down. Question number two, how can one neurotransmitter such as dopamine have such different functions from enabling work memory to giving us the experience of pleasure? So this is something that we're going to dive into to go into these notes. So I highly, again, recommend you guys check out the Fighter's Guide in full detail, is what neurotransmitters are responsible for what roles they play. But one of the biggest ones that you've already probably heard of but don't really fully understand, and I'm still trying to fully grasp the value of it and the understanding of what it does, is dopamine, which is typically associated with mood and happiness, but also it's correlated to working memory. Okay, so not just, hey, am I feeling good, but do I actually have a memory that I can recall both short-term and long-term? And then we'll even talk about memory later as well, because there's some really interesting facts about memory too. All right, so let's go into the fourth myth. Okay, and this is going to talk about the right and the left hemispheres and how they're going to kind of have these roles. And the really interesting myth for this one, to me, and this one I think is a really great myth that's been kind of just constantly revolved around for years, is logical people are left-brained and creatives are right-brained. Okay, and what that really breaks down to is, what do we associate lefties with? Being more creative, being more artsy, being more able to express themselves, which if you're a lefty, you're supposedly going to be right-brain dominant. And if you're a righty, you're going to be left-brain dominant. Again, you're going back to the logical for that. So you have to think, anything that your body controls, let's break our body up into right and left. We draw a line right down the center of our body. We actually have the brain is broken up in half, and it's connected by the corpus callosum. I just love that term, by the way. I've learned it back when I was in high school. For whatever reason, that was one of those terms. I could go over anatomy, and I have to review a couple terms to remember certain parts of the body, but the corpus callosum I will always remember for whatever reason. Anyways, it's the connecting tissue that connects the right and left hemisphere, okay? And it's full of matter, actually. And this is, again, so I can remember the corpus callosum, but I don't recall if it's white matter or gray matter. This is another thing we'll check in the notes as well. But the point of me saying that is that if we're a righty, that's being controlled by the left side of our body. And even if we're not a lefty, but the left side of our body and vision, hearing, all those things being controlled and interpreted by the right side of our brain, okay? So for them to work together, they have to cross over the corpus callosum and communicate, which then we can talk about other issues when people would have the corpus callosum cut or have any other kind of issues where the brains can't communicate with one another and how it still operates and fires and neurological signaling and all that fun stuff. But anyways, let's look at the truth to this myth. The hemispheres are highly interconnected through the corpus callosum. They didn't say that, but I'm throwing that in there. And work together in sync much of the time. Although there is some lateralization of function, meaning one side may be in control or may be more dominant in that function or action, many functions are bilateral, meaning they both are working together. And the left brain is necessary for creativity, not just the right brain. So if we're talking about the left brain, that's the right side of our body. So if you're a righty, don't think you can't be creative. Don't think that your buddy that's a lefty may or may not have an advantage just because they're lefty. Now, there is some truth, and we'll dive into parts of the right hemisphere and some things that we've seen and where these myths are based off of. But again, as we state in the truth, it that's just a part of it, okay? The brain is still interconnected to one another on both sides, so we can't just say, all right, well, lateralization here or isolation of one side of the brain, they're just going to be independent, and if you're a lefty, you're just significantly going to be way more creative than your righty counterparts just in and of itself. Now, you may happen to be more creative, and there may be some connections that are happening there. And there's also the placebo effect, in my opinion, where if you are perceived to be more creative because you're a lefty, you may spend more time on arts and crafts skills or creativity-based things and feed into that assumption. So that's just that part of it. All right, so first question at the end of our summary. Why would it be helpful to have some functions localized in one hemisphere or the other? So this is a fun question. So why do we even have the right and left hemisphere? And then why are parts of the brain in control of certain aspects of function? So think of it this way. If you do have brain trauma, and you see this, we'll see this when there's either accidents or chronic disease or anything like that, parts of the brain can deteriorate or be damaged. And if one part of the brain is damaged, imagine if the entire brain was the same uniform throughout and you just lost 30% of your brain, of all of your functions, from one localized injury. Now, if you also, we break down, look how the brain actually functions and how parts of the brain can be in control of different aspects. So if we lose one part of the brain, let's say it's a 30% chunk of the brain, doesn't mean we're going to actually lose 30% function and mass, or mass will be damaged, yes, but function, no. Because the beautiful thing about the brain is it can rewire itself. All those neurons and neurotransmitters can rework and reconstruct itself so that it finds different routes and pathways to make it function. Now, if the entire area is damaged, that's going to be a problem. And what I mean, the entire area, the entire localized area of, let's say, the frontal lobe, then you're going to see significant issues in what the frontal lobe is in control of, okay? Or if we're talking about the thalamus, or if we're talking about the pituitary gland, or any area of the brain that gets damaged, whatever it is specifically localized and associated to be in charge of, there's going to be issues to it. But the beauty is there's other aspects of the brain, and it can be rewired and re-networked to pick up some of that slack. Not all of it, and there can be problems there, but that's part of the beauty of the brain being wired the way it is. Two, in a healthy person who's, they bring it up, corpus callosum, the fiber tract that joins the two hemispheres, but they don't say if it's white or gray matter. I'm going to check it out for you guys, is intact. All right, so let me reread this. In a healthy person whose corpus callosum is intact, is there more communication between the hemispheres than within them? What does that mean in terms of how we understand lateralization? Ooh, this is a good question. So in a normal person with our corpus callosum that communicates or connects the left and right hemisphere, is there more communication between the right and left hemisphere, or does that information stay on the right side of the brain and stay on the left side of the brain? So that's a really good question. Okay, how is it possible that a person can be born with only one hemisphere and not know it? Oh, we'll dive into that. So there's a lot of details. Go into the Fighter's Guide. You'll see this, that we talk about the split brain case, or even out of contact, out of mind. Some of these different factors that we'll talk about examples of where they come into play. All right. Going into myth number five, chapter number five. Myth. Men's and women's brains are structurally different. Ooh, this is good, guys. We've all heard, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, right? Well, even if we are, the myth is going to be that our brains are different too. But truth, the similarities between the brains of men and women far outweigh the differences. And the differences are difficult to tease apart from different environments. All right, so let's kind of summarize that a little bit. So the idea is that our brains are different because men and women are different physiologically, supposedly. Well, obviously there's certain physiological differences, but the brains are going to be different as well. Now, not to say there aren't some differences here, but for the majority of it, the brain similarities are going to be way greater than those small differences. Now, it doesn't diminish that there are some differences, but for the most part, when you even look at meta-analysis of those brains, they kind of counteract each other and they break even, okay? And we'll dive really far into that. But I think this is a great myth, because so much is being separated. Well, that you have a man brain, or that's just a typical guy thought or whatever. And to me, that's more of the environment that's been molded over time and less of the physiological or the anatomical structure of how we're set up. Okay, so let's look at our questions to consider. Is there such a thing as male and female brain? Again, we just covered that in the myth, but there may be some little structural differences that can give you away. If you were to look at a brain under a scan, is there going to be a difference? Are there clear indications of, okay, this part of their brain is going to be slightly bigger, this brain is going to be slightly smaller, that's clearly male or that's clearly female? I'll dive into that even a little bit more. Question two, could you tell that just by looking at it? Meaning, could you tell a male or female brain just by looking at it? Again, that goes back to question number one. But here's the tricky thing. They have done those scans and they have seen, okay, and I'm going to butcher on what parts of the brain have been associated with different parts of sex, but there have been certain conditions in biological traits or even structure of the brain that are associated with men and women. But what I thought was interesting about this chapter is that, and we'll talk about it more in our notes, is that it's not just men and women, but it's straight men, straight women, gay men, gay women. And straight men and gay men have a different brain structure than, again, their counterparts. So, I should reword that. Straight men and gay men will have different brain structures, and they'll actually be, a gay man's brain will be similar in structure to a female brain with those, again, we talked about there may be slight differences, but for the most part, they're pretty much the same. Yes, but those slight differences that do kind of come up are going to be similar with a gay man's brain and a straight female's brain, and vice versa. For a straight man and a gay female, their brains are going to be structurally similar, and as far as the network firing and neurotransmitters and all that, they're going to be similar as well, which that's interesting. Okay, how much of the brain differences we see in men and women are a result of culture rather than biology? Can we ever tease those two apart? Can we ever really decide between, if you just objectively had a man born in an environment, a female born in an environment, and you take the culture and the environment and the nurture out of it, what are we going to see? Is there going to be differences? It's really hard to study that. It's really, really tough, because think about it. How many people are we going to get to be isolated from society and from culture that won't be influenced by it and that'll truly give an objective opinion? That one's, I think, going to be one of the hardest things that we'll ever try and find out. But it's a good question to raise. Okay. We're already up to chapter number six, myth number six. Let's see how we're doing on time here, guys. We're at, what, about 35, going on 40 minutes. That's not too bad. We might have to break this up into a three-parter. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how we go through this, and I'll see the response you guys get, because I might even do a three-part where it won't be back-to-back-to-back weeks. It might be every other week. Well, I'll do it this week, then the following week I'll have a guest on or something like that, maybe, and then we'll go back to our part two, and then we'll go into another thing, and then we'll go into part three, and then by then we might even be on February's month summary. But anyways, diving into our sixth myth. Your memory is an accurate reflection of what happened in the past. Oh, I love this one. And the truth of it is, memory is reconstructive. Each time we remember an event, we have to build that memory from scratch. And every instance of remembering changes the way that the memory will be retrieved in the future. So think about that for a second. Your childhood. Reflect on a day, your sixth birthday, if you can even remember it. If to build that memory, you literally have to reconstruct the entire memory from scratch. So you have to go through a brain process saying, okay, how long ago is that? Blah, 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 blah. And think about it. The further away that happens, the further away an experience gets, and the older you get, and the more experiences you have to reconstruct, that gives you a higher variability of error or of potentially saying, okay, I'm reinforcing something I was told, which we've also had that before. I don't know about you guys. I certainly have. There have been instances where there's no way I should remember an event that happened when I was 2 years old, but I can vividly remember, oh, I do remember that. I do remember that. And the reason I remember is because of pictures and because of stories I've been told that influences how my brain is recalling that particular memory. Which, then I ask this question. It's not necessarily brought up in the book, but then I ask, well, what do we really care about if my reality, quote unquote, is different than what the objective reality of what happened was? What's more important, what happened or what I perceive to have happened? And that goes more into the psychology of who we are and why we are the way we are and what happened and people and all that fun stuff. Because if, let's say, I was a child and I have a certain event that happened to me, and this can also explain some other diagnoses and some other situations. And again, I'm not a doctor, so take it with a grain of salt. But this is just thought process here. If we go back to when we were younger, and let's say the reality of the situation wasn't that bad. Let's say it was actually a good day, good situation, whatever you're recalling. But for whatever reason, the memory of it is a completely negative, damaging, just diseased memory of that particular day. That's more dangerous and more damaging than the actual truth and objective reality of what happened. So it goes to show that just because our brain is recording and we're observing our environment around us doesn't necessarily mean we're going to accurately reflect on it with our memory. That's why even going into a legal aspect, and this is where I think lawyers can exploit this, and they obviously do, and really good lawyers really can take advantage of this, is the memory is reconstructive, and that, and this is where it gets in trouble with witnesses, because it's easy, or can potentially be easy, to highlight that you don't have a really accurate remembrance of that situation. You can kind of feed them and lead them astray, or officers or detectives or investigators or whoever has been, you know, kind of interviewing an eyewitness can influence their thought process by saying, you saw this guy, right? This is the guy that you saw did it. And especially if you're emotionally vulnerable, and if it was something that's close to you, or you're scared or anything like that, or you're the actual person that's being convicted of a crime, it's very easy, or for me, it's easy to see how someone could even admit to something they didn't even do because of this myth and the truth aspect of it right here, that your memory isn't as accurate as you believe it to be, and it has to reconstruct a memory, so that if someone's influencing your reconstruction of that memory or feeding you for that reconstruction of your memory, you may actually even start to believe it at some point. Or you could just kind of highlight all the different holes. And then one of the interesting ones of this chapter is they talk about the seven sins of memory. And again, we'll break it down in our notes. But it's really intriguing, some of the things that they talk about, especially blocking when we're talking about neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, or even when you look at schizophrenia, what that could mean. And just even like when we talked about with an eyewitness, suggestibility. These are really interesting topics that we're diving into on that one that you guys really want to check out the Fighter's Guide for. But think about that. There's a lot to it. So questions to consider. If memory is reconstructive and prone to inaccuracies, what is the purpose of it? Okay, that's a crazy question, right? So if it's going to be inaccurate and it's going to be errored, the purpose of it, it's supposed to be one source. And that's a question that I don't even know how to answer that right off the bat. So we have to kind of look back at the text and then also kind of reflect, I think, ourselves. But it's a great question to ask. What's the purpose of it? Okay, second question. How should we interview potential eyewitnesses to get the most accurate picture of what really happened? Not how do we interview them to get our influential perspective onto them, but how do we get the most accurate picture of what really happened? Both legal departments and representatives should care about that question. So anyone that's a lawyer out there, police officer, you know, private investigator, FBI, agents, federal government, whatever, this is a really important question. And this is an important topic, and I think that there should be more spent on it. And again, I've never gone through any kind of department for legality. I've never tried to be a police officer. I've never tried to go into any of those stages. So I don't know how they train you for that. And I'm sure there's information out there, and I'm sure more people educated on that can talk about it. Maybe we'll even have a guest on to talk about that. But I think there's a lot that we could learn and even grow with that process as the current state that it's in. All right. So we got six down. And I think I'm going to put a pause on it for this one, guys, because I try to not get the audio guys to go too far in advance here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put this one out. We're going to stop at chapter 6. We're going to have our six myths for this week. And then I'm going to break it down. And I think we're going to end up, I like kind of covering six. It's a good amount of time. We got about 40 minutes in. It was like 5 minutes of ads. And what I'll do is we'll do four parts. It'll be a four-parter, so that by the time the fourth part's out, we'll be already started, ready to gear up for our next book. And we'll try and sneak in some guests in between, but it'll be good because in case some guests can't come on, we've had some real issues with scheduling just because life is crazy, guys. We know that. The more awesome I think a guest is, the more packed their schedule is going to be. I think it's going to be harder to nail down a time to get them on, but we're going to work on that. I want to give a big shout out to one of our professional boxers, Michael Stout, won his fight this past weekend. at the Paramount in Huntington, New York, on Long Island. It was the January 26th. Friday on the 26th. Yeah, Mike, doing what you do, bro. I'm proud of you, man. He's undefeated still, 3-0. And I know it's been hard because nobody wants to fight this dude. It's hard at his weight class. He fights it between 118 and 124. Or 123, I forgot if it's 23 or 24, and you know, he tries to put on weight to go up to make it easier to find opponents, but A, that weight is hard to find people, and B, even when you do find people, he's got such a prolific background and kind of record, he's a scary fighter that no one really wants to fight him. So shout out to him for getting the fight, being able to show up, perform, do what he does. We're proud to be a part of his team, being able to help him and sponsor him. Highly recommend you guys check him out. And again, to recap, this episode has been brought to you by NutriPrice. Check them out, NutriPrice.com. Click on the link below. Audible, get your free trial today. Click on the link below. Amazon, if you guys want to support us, you can click on our Amazon link below. Get any of the things that you need. We'll get a nice, not nice, but it's a little kickback. It's nothing crazy. Again, it doesn't make or break us. We appreciate it if you do, though. And as always, the Life of a Fighter shop, where you can get this fighter's guide. Again, what I'm always going to do is the audio will always be available to you guys, but the content that goes with it may not. So if you want the fighter's guide that we were discussing in this one or any other podcast or episode, go over to the shop, get the fighter's guide. It'll be between $1 and $10 depending on when you can take advantage of it. Or if you want access to multiple fighter guides and ebooks and content, I highly recommend take advantage of the Fitness and Nutrition Vault. That's a $5 a month membership where you get access to all of this stuff. It's all included. Or you could pay $50 for the year, whatever you want to do. And then again, we have our Pro Coach program where you're going to get customized programming, planning, nutrition, and training, daily lessons, weekly check-ins. And then we even have our premium services where we not only do all of that, plus we're going to be training with you on a weekly basis, 3 to 4 sessions a week. We'll help you go food shopping. We'll even, if needed, we'll provide the food for you. We'll have a meal prep company come in, all that good stuff. It's all part of the package. So hope you guys enjoy. Again, I apologize for putting out this a couple days late. And again, I put out a post the other day with, we had questions and topics that you want to see covered on top of this. We got some feedback on that. And a lot of them were actually covered in the chapters. So I kind of just stuck to that. But again, if you guys have questions, if you guys have some other myths that you want to have talk about, some other brain concepts, feel free to email us, info@lifeofafighter.com. Check us on social media. If you guys don't know it by now, check the links below. But you should, and I appreciate you guys listening as always. We will check you next week for the 100th episode. We're going to be celebrating some giveaways, some fun stuff, so check it out. So I just wanted to say thank you guys again for watching, listening, consuming that episode. If you guys enjoyed it and you haven't already, please like, please comment. If you haven't reviewed, please leave a review. If you haven't followed or subscribed, please do that as well. Again, it tremendously helps us out. And then just a quick reminder, if you guys want more resources, we have them below. We have our programs, everything from free all the way up to paid and kind of everything in between. Dial in with the customization, and we have more information on different programs and resources in our newsletter. So if you haven't signed up for that, do so below. It's free. And that is it, y'all. See you on the next one.